From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!'s Countdown to the Showdown, the battle for New York.
New York is a non-swing state, so I think people can vote what they believe in. If they oppose the Iraq War, they can show that by voting for Nader here in New York.
Well, New York is not a swing state, but I think what's happening in my campaign is an analysis of the Democratic Party positions on issues, going from the most progressive Democrats to, on the right, the Lieberman ideology, and what direction the Democratic Party nationally should be going.
As the attention in the nation focuses on battleground states, we'll look at different views on voting in safe states with two candidates, a Green Party candidate and a Democratic Party candidate, Frank Barbaro and Dave McReynolds. Then to Ohio, where the GOP challenged the voting rights of thousands of people ahead of the election. State legislators are calling for the resignation of the Ohio Secretary of State. And Yasser Arafat is headed to Paris.
I hope that Mr. Arafat will fully recover. If not, it will be a disaster for Israel.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, countdown to the showdown, the battle for New York. In election news, the Los Angeles Times is reporting that Bush administration lawyers are now attempting to overturn decades of legal precedents by claiming that only Attorney General John Ashcroft and not individual voters have a right to go to the federal courts to enforce voting rights. In legal briefs filed in Ohio, Michigan, and Florida, the Bush administration's arguing that the new Help America Vote Act stipulates only the Justice Department and not voters themselves may sue to enforce voting rights. Veteran voting rights lawyers say this would overturn decades of legal precedent and could greatly affect any legal challenge to Tuesday's election. According to the Los Angeles Times, since the civil rights era of the 60s, individuals have gone to federal court to enforce their right to vote, often with the support of groups like the NAACP, the AFL-CIO, and the League of Women Voters. J. Gerald Hebert, a former chief of the Justice Department's Voting Rights Section, said he was dismayed that the government is seeking to weaken a measure designed to protect voters. Hebert, who worked in the Voting Rights Section from 1973 to 94, said, quote, "This is the first time in history the Justice Department has gone to court to side against voters who are trying to enforce their right to vote. I think this law will mean very little if the rights of American voters have to depend on this Justice Department." Even the Supreme Court has backed the idea of private suits. In 1969, the justices issued a ruling in a case related to the Voting Rights Act of 1965 that, quote, "the achievement of the Act's laudable goal would be severely hampered if each citizen were required to depend solely on litigation instituted at the discretion of the Attorney General." A local TV station in Minnesota has aired video from Iraq that new questions about how much effort U.S. troops made to secure deadly explosives after the U.S. invasion. On Monday, the New York Times revealed that more than 370 tons of highly explosive materials went missing from the Al-Qaqa military base. The Bush administration has attempted to downplay the story, claiming that the explosives were likely already gone when the U.S. troops arrived. But now the ABC affiliate in Minnesota has broadcast footage from its embedded reporter who traveled to Al-Qaqa with the U.S. troops. The video shows GIs breaking the locks on storage bunkers to reveal barrels and barrels labeled explosive. Meanwhile, a military officer admitted to Knight Ridder that the U.S. didn't have the resources to secure the sites. The officer said, quote, "We weren't able to respond because we didn't have anyone to send." A new peer-reviewed study has concluded that at least 100,000 Iraqi civilians have died because of the U.S. invasion last year. The study appears in the British medical journal Lancet and was conducted by researchers at Columbia University, Johns Hopkins, as well as Medical University in Baghdad. The rise in the death rate was mainly due to violence, and much of it was caused by U.S. airstrikes in towns and cities. The estimated number of deaths is considerably higher than previous estimates. The U.S. military claims it does not keep tallies on civilian casualties. The researchers made its calculation based on door-to-door surveys in Baghdad, where they gathered data to determine how the country's death rate has changed since the U.S. invaded Iraq. Other estimates have put the civilian toll between 16,000 and 35,000. The international journalist group Reporters Without Borders has issued its annual report on press freedom. The U.S. now ranks 22nd in press freedom among the world's countries. The report criticized the U.S. on a number of grounds, including, quote, violations of source confidentiality, persistent problems in granting press visas, and the arrest of several journalists during anti-Bush demonstrations. The study also determined that Iraq had become, quote, the most deadly place on earth for journalists. Meanwhile, in Iraq, gunmen have killed an Iraqi newsreader who worked at the Al-Sharqiya television station in Baghdad. Her husband was murdered 2 months ago. The motive for her killing was not clear. In other Iraq news, the FBI has launched a criminal investigation into whether the Pentagon improperly awarded Halliburton no-bid contracts worth billions of dollars. The FBI has sought permission to interview Bunnington Greenhouse, the chief contracting officer at the Army Corps of Engineers, who's publicly questioned if Halliburton had unfairly been awarded the contracts. Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat is scheduled to arrive in France today to seek urgent medical treatment at a military hospital. 2 days ago, Arafat collapsed and briefly lost consciousness. Aides to Arafat said he was, quote, very frail. This marks the first time in over 2 years that Arafat has left his Ramallah compound. In Oregon, three school teachers were recently removed from a Bush campaign event and threatened with arrest. Although the women had tickets for the event and were not engaged in any form of public protest, security guards approached them after seeing their T-shirts that read, "Protect our civil liberties." One of the teachers, Janet Voorhees, said, quote, "I want to see if I would be able to make a statement that I feel is important but not offensive in a rally for my president." Last month in Eugene, Oregon, Perry Patterson was arrested. He was 54 years old. He was charged with criminal trespass after attending a campaign event by Vice President Dick Cheney. When Cheney told the crowd that President Bush has made the world safer, Patterson blurted out the word no, arrested soon afterwards. And earlier this week, police dragged out three protesters from a Bush campaign rally in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, after the protesters shouted out that the president was a liar. The Internal Revenue Service has launched an investigation to determine whether the nonprofit NAACP improperly intervened in a political campaign when its chair, Julian Bond, gave a major speech condemning the Bush administration's policies. Bond said yesterday, quote, "I think what's at issue is our right to criticize the president of the United States. The IRS is saying because I criticize the president's education policies, his economic policies, and his war policies, that somehow I place the tax exemption for the NAACP at risk." During the speech in question, Bond said, quote, "The NAACP has always been nonpartisan, but that doesn't mean we're noncritical. For as long as we've existed, whether Democrats or Republicans have occupied the White House, we've spoken truth to power."
Thank you.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the countdown to the showdown. The battle for New York. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan. The battle for the White House. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country. Well, the Bush administration lawyers are attempting to overturn legal precedents by claiming that only Attorney General John Ashcroft and not individual voters have a right to go to federal courts to enforce the right of citizens to vote. This, according to the Los Angeles Times. In legal briefs filed in Ohio, Michigan, and Florida, the Bush administration is arguing that only the Justice Department and not voters themselves may sue to enforce the voting rights set out in the new Help America Vote Act, which was passed after the 2000 election. Veteran voting rights lawyers say this would overturn decades of legal precedent and would greatly affect any legal challenges to Tuesday's election.
Meanwhile, in Ohio, a federal judge has temporarily blocked the Republican Party from challenging the voting rights of 35,000 people ahead of the election. Local election boards were preparing to hold hearings in the next few days to decide on the eligibility of voters in question. The Democratic Party hailed the decision. The head of its voter protection program said the Republican assault on tens of thousands of Ohio voters was an unprecedented effort to intimidate voters, especially minorities, but it has backfired. Republican attorneys said the party will now be forced to challenge the voters on Election Day at the polls in order to prevent voting fraud. We're joined right now by Teresa Fetter, Ohio State Senator. She is one of the lawmakers who is currently calling for the Ohio Secretary of State, Ken Blackwell, to resign. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, and good morning.
It's good to have you with us. Well, from the national picture to what's happening in Ohio, the whole issue of voting rights is clearly the top story. Can you talk about why you want Blackwell out?
Well, from the very beginning, this started about 2 years ago with Secretary of State Blackwell setting up obstacles for clean, fair elections in Ohio. It's been clear from the very beginning that he is taking his direction from the time that he was down in Florida, you know, helping the Republican Party in 2000. And he was one of their principal electoral system advisors. Then he also became part of their Bush spin team and went around with the rounds of cable national network television and radio broadcast tents and touted the Republican side. And you know, I've been paying attention to this from the very beginning. There have been clear signs along the way from the electronic voting machines to the 11th hour directives that came down from his office that caused chaos and confusion to the boards of elections and to citizens. And also, with the spirit of HAVA, you know, the provisional balloting issue. Provisional balloting is used for, you know, the process of fail-safe voting. And we come from the perspective that, you know, if you are an eligible voter, you have a right to cast a ballot and for that ballot to be counted. That's what HAVA was all about. And that, those were the lessons that we learned in Florida.
And in terms of the reaction of citizen groups there, because obviously Ohio has now become next to Florida, the sort of the ground zero for these questions in terms of voter suppression. In terms of the ability of these citizen groups to be able to raise these challenges, are you surprised by this LA Times report that's come out that the Bush administration is taking the stand that only the Attorney General has the right to challenge voter suppression or voting rights violations?
I'm not surprised at all, because if you think back in the election 2000, who was the first group to lobby the legal battle? It was the Bush administration. And it doesn't surprise me that they're trying to lock in on the legal side of this so that the citizens lose their rights. And it seems to me like we still have states' rights here. And I believe that the Attorney General has done a poor job of protecting people's rights to vote. He's more concerned about voter fraud than voter protection. And we are on the side of voter protection, especially those who have just registered. And in Ohio, we have registered 250% more than Republicans. And if you recall, there was a Republican Michigan legislator, John Papa George, who admitted, if we do not suppress the Detroit vote, we're going to have a tough time in this election. So it's clear. There have been signs along the way. We are here to protect the eligible voters, and we will do everything in our power to have a smooth election. We are anticipating their tactics of voter suppression, and I think the American people need to wake up. I often, wonder if we're just frogs in a pot, and we absolutely need to pay attention now, not after. If there was anything that we learned with the Florida election, it was that we need to be absolutely prepared to have a smooth election and to anticipate this. And my thought is, why aren't we prepared for 100% voter turnout in America?
We're talking to Ohio State Senator Teresa Fetter, calling on the Ohio Secretary of State, Ken Blackwell, to resign. What do you see as the key issue now for voter access around Ohio? People are talking about it as a possible next Florida.
Well, they need to check to see whether or not they're eligible to vote, and then try to figure out why they're not eligible to vote if they're not on the voter polls. They also need to make sure that they're going to the correct poll site, and there's a way to do that. You can call the Board of Election, you can check online, and also go to the Democratic Party or Republican Party to help you through that process. I believe you need to take identification, both driver's license and a piece of mail that has your current address, and just be prepared. I think we should go, earlier in the morning. If there are any problems in long lines, then you can prepare your day, accordingly.
Let me ask you a question about Diebold and electronic voting. Walden O'Dell comes from Ohio. He is the head of Diebold, and he was the one who said, we will try to deliver the vote to George Bush in this next election.
That letter came to me, and I sent it out from my office. I was very concerned from the very beginning, and I believe it's a conflict of interest. We should have no voting machine companies or election companies directly involved with contributions to our elected officials, number one. That is a number one problem in my mind. And I believe that he got caught in that net. And we have a lot to do with election reform yet. We have a great deal of work that needs to be done. And, after this election, I'm hoping that we move forward with more election reform laws.
We're also joined on the telephone by Stephen Mulroy, an assistant professor at the University of Memphis, a law school, and a former Justice Department attorney. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Professor Mulroy, could you talk to us about this L.A. Times article that came out in terms of the Justice Department taking the stand that it is the under HAVA, the new Voting Rights Protection Act, that only the Justice Department can sue on behalf of citizens over voting rights violations?
Right. I haven't seen the article, but I was I didn't believe someone might have talked to me about it. The issue is whether there is what you call a private right of action under the statute. Sometimes statutes will expressly provide that not only federal agencies but private individuals will have the right to enforce the federal statute through a private suit. Sometimes they won't expressly provide, but an implied right of action is discerned by the courts. Sometimes the courts will discern that there is no private right of action, and it's a legal question. With respect to HAVA, the Help Americans Vote Act that was passed 2 years ago by Congress, the Department of Justice has taken the position in the lawsuits under HAVA that have been sprouting up around the country that there is no private right of action. This is a controversial position. I think it's debatable on the merits, but the interesting thing is that some people have criticized the Justice Department because it's not completely unprecedented for the Justice Department to take this position, but somewhat unusual. Normally, you would think that the agency that's charged with enforcing the law would welcome assistance from private groups in also enforcing the law. And in the past, there have been some instances where there were similar issues with respect to the Voting Rights Act, and the Department of Justice took the position that there was a private right of action. As recently as 1996, in a case called Morse v. Republican Party, which went all the way up to the Supreme Court, with respect to Section 10 of the Voting Rights Act, the Justice Department took the position in litigation that there was a private right of action. So I think it caused some surprise and some dismay among voting rights advocates when the Department of Justice recently took the position that there was no private right of action under HAVA.
And what about the fact that it's ultimately all in the control of John Ashcroft?
Well, I mean, you know, from the perspective of a progressive or a person who's very concerned about, preserving Voting Rights Act, certainly that could lead to some suspicions because, you know, I mean, I don't think we need to recite the record of John Ashcroft for the last several years. If you don't trust the current attorney general to vigorously enforce protections, you know, regarding voter access or to do it in a fair manner, then one natural check in the system would be if you had a private right of action. That's one of the advantages of having a private right of action in something as fundamental as voting rights in that area. So, you know, obviously that's a concern.
And going back to the headline in 69, the Supreme Court issuing a ruling in a case related to the Voting Rights Act of 1965, saying, quote, the achievement of the act's laudable goal would be severely hampered if each citizen were required to depend solely on litigation instituted at the discretion of the Attorney General.
Well, first of all, that is a correct quote. The Supreme Court has said that. Second of all, I personally believe that that's true. I agree with that statement on the merits. I think that with something as fundamental as protecting Voting Rights Act, you want to have a broad interpretation of private rights of action. So I agree with all of that. I mean, you know, as a technical legal matter, sometimes, you know, when you look at what the legislative intent is, when you look at the language, you look at the legislative history, sometimes as a legal matter, there is an argument for saying there is no private right of action. And I haven't thoroughly researched this issue, but from what I know of it, it really sounds like it would be a good idea to have a private right of action. And I was surprised when I heard that DOJ took the position that it did.
Well, we want to thank you very much for being with us. Stephen Mulroy, ex-voting rights litigator for the U.S. Justice Department, now a law professor at the University of Memphis, and Ohio State Senator Teresa Federer. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
This river I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know change has gotta come now. Ooh, yes it is now. Oh my, oh my. It's been too the clouds. It's been a long time coming. I know change has gotta come.
Otis Redding, Change is Going to Come. Here on Democracy Now!, the countdown to the showdown, the battle for the White House. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
As thousands of people continue to cast their ballots ahead of next Tuesday's election, there are several races across the country that are very close and bring with them high stakes. The balance of the Senate is up for grabs, and Minority Leader Tom Daschle of South Dakota is fighting to retain his powerful position. He's facing a fierce challenge from conservative Republican John Thune. That race is being dubbed the second most important race in the country. This comes as the latest polls put President Bush and John Kerry in a dead heat in the battle for the White House.
Both Bush and Kerry continue their focus on swing states. The president spoke at a rally of his supporters in Michigan, while John Kerry addressed a massive rally of more than 80,000 people in Wisconsin. But as the attention of the country is focused in on the so-called battleground states, a debate rages in the safe states, states where either Kerry or Bush are almost guaranteed a victory. The Green Party is advocating what it calls a safe state strategy, telling its voters to cast their ballots for John Kerry and not their candidate in the battleground states. Joining us today to talk about this and their own candidacies are candidates in the safe state in New York. We're joined by Dave McReynolds, Green Party candidate for the U.S. Senate in New York in 2000. He was a Socialist Party candidate for president, a longtime staff member of the War Resisters League, one of the first people to burn his draft card during the Vietnam War. We're also joined by Frank Barbaro. He's running for Congress in New York's 13th District, which includes Staten Island and Brooklyn. He's running on the Democratic ticket. Former longshoreman, ran for New York City mayor in 1981. He's a longtime New York State Assembly member and was a state Supreme Court justice. And we welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Well, I'd like to start with Dave McReynolds. Tell us about the safe state strategy and why you believe here in New York that that progressives should be voting for you for the U.S. Senate.
Well, in New York, it's very simple because Chuck Schumer is absolutely sure to go back into the Senate. He's got $26 million for the campaign. He's not going to be defeated, which means you have a very clear chance if you oppose the war in Iraq, if you oppose the Patriot Act, if you're for same-sex marriage, if you're against capital punishment, if you want the drug laws changed, then you can vote for me on the green ticket. In terms of the presidential race, I think this is an unusual chance in New York where there's no way that Kerry is going to lose New York State. I'm hoping Frank Barbaro wins, and I think it's too late in the campaign for my support to do any damage. It's too close to Election Day. But I think that Kerry is sure to carry the state, which means that you're free to vote for Ralph Nader. Whatever you think of him on other grounds, that's a solid protest vote for in the presidential race. So those are two votes people in New York can cast.
And Frank Barbaro, you've joined us on Democracy Now! You're a longtime progressive and in the State Assembly for many years in Supreme Court. And I remember back in 1990-91 when we were on strike at the New York Daily News. And in a very, very tough battle, you were the person who held a very important hearing where you called the owners of the Daily News, the publishers and the editors, to an important legislative hearing that really brought out a lot of the issues of the lockout that the company was involved in. Could you talk to us about your view about what first New Yorkers should do here in terms of voting for president, and then also the importance of your race in particular?
Well, I think as far as the Kerry campaign is concerned, as many people as can should go to the swing states and get involved in those campaigns. Doesn't help me because many of them are volunteers in my campaign, but I believe the presidential race is much more important than mine. My campaign, I decided to run because I saw it as a vehicle to reclaim the soul of the Democratic Party. The issues that I'm running on are progressive issues based upon workers' rights, anti-war, pro-environment, pro-gay and lesbian rights. People said that would not fly on Staten Island. Staten Island is considered a bastion of right-wing thinking Democrats cannot win on Staten Island, that Republicans have controlled it and will control it forever. My theory is that this is a test tube case where someone with labor support, broad base coalition, can run in that state, in that congressional district, and do well or possibly win. And that would have an effect on the party nationally. That's why I made the race. And I'm just ecstatic because the message resonated and has been resonated among blue-collar workers on Staten Island, so much so that a recent poll came out that showed Fisella, who's the right-wing candidate, and myself are in a dead heat. So with very little money, I think we've won. Whether I win or lose on Tuesday night, we have invigorated the labor movement. We have proven that if the labor movement comes together and supports a progressive candidate that can appeal to the blue-collar workers and the white-collar workers on Staten Island, that they can win. It would change the soul of the Democratic Party. And I think we've already accomplished that.
What about this idea of in a safe state, supposedly like New York, what do you think of Dave McReynolds' idea of the Green Party, idea of voting for third-party candidates for the Green Party in a place like New York, especially around issues of anti-war activism?
Well, in a general sense, I can agree with that logic. But too many times, general logic leads you to wrong conclusions. I think the NADA campaign, in its very essence, is a tragic mistake. I was a supporter of NADA. I'm very angry at NADA right now. I'm angry at him because when he ran 4 years ago, he fooled many of us. He betrayed many of us because he was talking about building a movement between elections and that he would be the leader of that movement. But he didn't do that. He walked away from the struggle. And then when it's time to run for president, he comes back on the scene. That, to me, is not the way you build a mass movement. And he persists in doing that. So in that sense, I am opposed to him, even on the basis of running a candidate in a safe state. I think it's a mistake. We need to build a broad-based people's movement. And you don't win elections 2 or 3 months before the election. You win elections by starting the campaign the day after you lost.
I actually agree in a large part with what Frank is saying. I wish David Cobb were on the ballot here in New York State. He's the Green Party's actual nominee, but he didn't make the ballot. I'm voting for Nader as a protest vote, but I agree with the problems of not building an organization or building a movement. I think in New York State, where Kerry will take the state, I would find it impossible to vote for someone who is simply telling the American public they're going to kill the Iraqis more efficiently and more effectively. I want a candidate who's really against the war. And at this point, that's either Ralph Nader or one of the other minor party candidates. And I think in those states, the safe states, it's good for Kerry and good for the Democratic Party to see that they do not have control of all the voters, that there are a lot of voters who want clearly an alternative. But I do worry that people will end up not voting for someone like Frank, whom I think they should be voting for. I hope they will split their ballots. I hope they'll vote for me on the I think it's line I, as well as voting for Nader, who's on a different line. He's not on the Green Party line, and voting for Frank in his area, where Frank, by the way, has a lot of support. I don't know anyone that I've talked to who's not enthusiastic about or hasn't been involved in Frank's campaign.
Frank Barbaro, the current congressman for that district, Vito Fisella, is one of the most conservative, I guess, of the New York delegation. But yet you were considered a long shot initially, although clearly that race has been tightening. What about Fisella's record do you think would indicate to people that they shouldn't be voting for him?
Well, there are more and more people. The poll that was taken is a statistical dead heat. He has, 42% of the vote. I had 36% of the vote. And statistically, that's a dead heat. But what they found was that 60% or 40% of the people don't know me. And that when they do know me, do know what my program is, do know what Fisella has done in Congress, they switch right over to me. And so the issues are he's against gun control. He's against overtime pay. He's against the minimum wage. Supported that Medicare drug prescription bill. He strongly supports the war in Vietnam.
And Iraq.
Iraq. I'm losing my historic background. He's a clone. He is a clone for the right wing and the Republican Party. I mean, he went to Iraq, and when Bush delivered that turkey, which turned out to be a fake turkey.
On Thanksgiving.
Thanksgiving. So he speaks for Bush. And in many of the discussions, I shouldn't say many, he ducked almost all the discussions, forums, debates. But he says, I support the president. So this is another case where in this campaign, people are casting their votes as a referendum regarding the Bush campaign in Iraq.
I think the same thing is true in the Senate race, where Schumer, the distance between Schumer and Bush is a very narrow one. Schumer has been enthusiastic, not reluctant, but enthusiastic in supporting the war in Vietnam. He was for the Patriot Act.
Yeah. The war in Iraq again, right?
We're still back to Vietnam. That shows we're all getting older. Yeah, an enthusiastic supporter of the war in Iraq. And I think it is really outrageous for Schumer, particularly in a city which has a large gay and lesbian population, to come out against gay marriage. I really think this is contemptible on his part. And I also don't know, although that's not nearly as important in my mind as the issue of killing people and being killed in Iraq, I don't understand why gays and lesbians shouldn't suffer from the same angst, anxiety, tribulations, and trials of marriage which, you know, heterosexuals have to go through. Why should we be exempt from these problems? So that's a fake issue, but Schumer has dodged that issue along with many others, and I think people should cast a strong protest vote against Chuck Schumer.
What do you think, Frank Barbaro, about this issue of John Kerry and Iraq, his support to vote for the authorization of Iraq, saying vote for the authorization of the invasion, saying if he knew then what he knew now, he would have still voted the same way?
I think it was a fundamental mistake. Let me just back up a step. One of the things I've been doing in my campaign is saying that it was a mistake to go to Iraq in the first place. And what's interesting is that after I speak, people nod in agreement. More and more of them are nodding in agreement. Kerry, I believe, made a strategic error, a basic strategic error, in voting for the invasion. There was no way in my mind that he should have made that vote, because it put him in a position where he could be attacked as a flip-flopper. And it's been very difficult for him to extricate himself from that box. So when Giuliani said, well, I don't know what his position is, he voted for it, then he voted against sending money to protect the troops, and now he's saying he would have done the same thing had he known. So I think he made a fundamental error. He's smart, he's articulate, and unfortunately, I think he took the bad advice from the consultants. And now he finds himself in this position where he's in a dead heat, and I think he would have been at least 5 points ahead.
Yeah, let me ask you, if I can, about a turnout. Even though New York is not considered one of the swing states, all indications are that there's going to be near-record turnout. And my discussions with the Board of Elections here, they've had to order about 400 new machines to be able to deal with what they anticipate will be record turnout. How would that affect either of your candidacies, a larger-than-usual turnout?
We don't have enough campaign workers to cover the machines and to make sure of the vote. And we know that the Green candidate, my candidate, is not going to win. So that it will affect our vote a little bit, but I think not nearly as much as it would affect Frank Barbaro's vote. I would just like to give the website, if people want information on the McReynolds campaign, it's www.mcreynoldsforsenate.org, and they can get information on our positions there and how to help on Election Day.
To follow up your question, I think a large vote helps us because an analysis of the past results of campaigns are that there's a 30% drop after people vote for president. 30% don't vote for anyone else. And I think the fact that we have done so well is dramatized by the 6 years I spent on the bench. I spoke to court officers. And as a group, they're quite conservative, and many of them live on Staten Island. And I raised the issues that we're discussing here with them. And they would say to me, you know, Judge, you have some crazy ideas, but you should run for mayor again, or you should run for office again. The point I make is that if you craft your message not in a arrogant way, but in a very respectful way to workers, they will understand and they will respond. And our problem now is to get that 60% that don't know there is a Frank Barbaro. And we need funds. And if anybody wants to contribute, we're at www.barbaro4.com.
Well, I want to thank you, Frank Barbaro, for joining us, running for Congress in New York's 13th District, which is Staten Island and Brooklyn, and Dave McReynolds, Green Party candidate for the Senate in New York. I want to thank you both for being with us. We come back, a novel idea. It's called VotePack.com. And then we'll talk about Yasser Arafat going to France. Stay with us. Miles Davis, So What? Here on Democracy Now!, the countdown to the showdown, the battle for the White House. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Before we look at the latest situation with Yasser Arafat sick and going to Paris, we have Sam Husseini on the line, who's a political analyst based in Washington, founder of the website VotePack.com. As we continue on this theme of people struggling with who to vote for, what is your suggestion, Sam?
My suggestion is that people who, take the most obvious case, somebody who, say, wants Ralph Nader to be president, but they feel like they got to vote for Kerry because they don't want Bush. My suggestion is to reach out across the two-party divide, find a disenchanted Bush voter. There are Bush voters who, if they thought about it a little bit, might actually prefer somebody like either a Libertarian or Constitution Party or conceivably even Ralph Nader. And if you have a relationship with this person, a friend, a coworker, a neighbor, whatever, as people say, okay, we'll both, instead of wasting our votes and both canceling out each other, one of us voting for Kerry and one of us voting for Bush, let's both vote for the third party of our choice. They can both vote for Nader, or one can vote for Nader or the Green or the Socialist, and the other can vote for the Constitution or Libertarian parties. That way you're siphoning off votes at, you know, by twos, one from each Kerry and Bush, and giving them two third parties. You don't affect the balance between the two parties, but you do help third parties. What this requires is meaningful dialogue with, God forbid, a would-be Bush voter, to actually reach out, see them as a human being, and try to do something that benefits you both and gets you out of the partisan boxes so that you're not stuck voting for Kerry with all of his lies and hypocrisies, and they're not stuck voting for Bush with all of his lies and hypocrisies.
But, Sam, your proposal assumes, obviously, that the Republican counterpart or Democratic counterpart in this deal or arrangement will keep his or her word and won't actually end up lying in the same way that the candidates are, right?
Well, largely, the one way around that would be that if you both had absentee ballots. If you both had absentee ballots, you could both sit down, fill them out in front of each other, walk down to the mailbox, and mail them together. That's one surefire solution. Short of that, I mean, the webpage, votepack.com, I'm not trying to link people up who, you know, meet each other over the Internet. It's just an idea. You know, I mean, do you trust your wife? Do you trust your brother? Do you trust, you know, even your brother-in-law who might be annoying over the Thanksgiving table because you disagree with him politically, but you kind of like him as a human being? So I'm saying people who you have a relationship with, people who you, you know, break bread with and look in the eye, and you can trust. I mean, if we're going to be a nation of liars, then maybe we get what we deserve. But if we can find a way out of that and find a way to either verify what the other party is doing through absentee ballots or by having relationships, at, you know, that come out of meaningful dialogue with each other, then you can trust each other.
Sam Husseini, founder of the website VotePact.com. Thanks for joining us. As we turn now to our last story, which is about Yasser Arafat flying to Paris. The Palestinian leader is on his way to France for emergency medical treatment after his health deteriorated this week when he collapsed and lost consciousness. Associates described Arafat as too weak to stand Thursday and say he appeared confused and spent much of the day sleeping. The 75-year-old president, former guerrilla leader, waved to crowds from a helicopter as he flew out of his shell-battered compound in Ramallah. He was accompanied by his wife, Suha, who had arrived in Ramallah from Paris a day earlier to see her husband for the first time in 4 years. Arafat has been holed up in the compound for the past 3 years due to travel restrictions put on him by the Israeli government. Scores of tearful bystanders, bodyguards, officials chanted using his nom de guerre, saying, quote, "We will sacrifice our blood and souls for you, Abu Ammar." Arafat serves as the president to the Palestinian Authority and chair of the Palestine Liberation Organization. He's been international face of Palestinian resistance for over 3 decades.
After arriving at Amman Airport in Jordan, he was carried by doctors on a wheelchair to a waiting French presidential jet. Lying on a stretcher inside the jet, he told aides, quote, "God willing, I will come back." Israeli officials have said that if Arafat recovers, he would be able to return to the West Bank. Reuters reports the promise came from senior Sharon aide Don Weissglass. In the past, Israel was unwilling to make such promises. A senior Palestinian official told Reuters that Arafat was believed to be suffering from leukemia, though more tests were needed for a firm diagnosis. One of his doctors said he did not believe Arafat had leukemia, but the BBC later quoted him as saying Arafat would be tested for the disease when he reached Paris. After his health deteriorated, officials said he had been slipping in and out of consciousness, though on Thursday he was able to eat, talk, and say prayers. Numerous questions have been raised as to who would succeed Arafat if he becomes incapacitated or dies. He has refused to name a successor. Many fear his death would plunge Palestine into a profound crisis. Arafat's mother-in-law, Rimonda Al-Tawil, said, quote, "He is more than a spiritual leader. He is a father. He is everything to us."
We go now to Tel Aviv, to Uri Avneri. He is an Israeli writer and peace activist with Gush Shalom, former member of the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, a member of the right-wing Irgun underground in the 1940s. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Good day.
It's good to have you with us. When did you last see Yasser Arafat?
About a month ago. He was he appeared quite healthy.
What is your reaction to his state of health now and what this means for him to be leaving Ramallah and going to Paris for medical treatment?
Well, it's bad that his state is as it is. I think we need Yasser Arafat. The Palestinians need him. I think Israel needs him, because he is the only man who can not only sign a peace treaty, but get his own people to accept a peace treaty. Any peace treaty will demand from the Palestinians very painful concessions to give up things which are sacred to them. And only a leader with a great personal moral authority such as Arafat can do that. Arafat is indeed the father of the nation. He is the Palestinian George Washington, and I don't see anyone around for the time being who could fulfill this task, who does have the authority. It is deep roots in the consciousness of the Palestinian people, as Yasser Arafat, who has led the Palestinian national movement right from the beginning during 44 years. So I hope that he will recover, and if he recovers, he will come back. No one can stop Yasser Arafat from coming back. There has been a promise by Ariel Sharon to the foreign minister of the European Community that he will be allowed back. And I don't believe that even Sharon can afford to break a promise like this.
But at the same time, though, both Sharon and President Bush for the past 4 years have refused to deal with Arafat in any significant way. And do you think that if he is incapacitated or passes away, that the what will be your sense of what will occur within the Palestinian Authority? Will the Palestinian movement move more in a rejectionist path, or more in a path of trying to develop leaders who would be able to negotiate with the Bush administration and with Sharon?
It's very difficult to foresee, because such a catastrophic event as the passing away of Yasser Arafat will create conditions which cannot be foreseen, which can work in many different ways. What will happen in the beginning, I suppose, will be a kind of collective leadership by some Palestinian officials who until now had based their authority on the backing of Yasser Arafat. Yasser Arafat appointed all of them. Now, if they have to stand on their own legs, it's very doubtful how effective they can be. They can administer the day-to-day affairs of the Palestinian people, and as you know, it is extremely difficult, because all the Palestinians are still living under Israeli occupation and under the daily incursions of the Israeli army. But any initiative beyond that, either way, will be very difficult for these people to take, and I don't expect them to take any initiative beyond what Yasser Arafat has prescribed, which is to agree to a peace based on the creation of a state of Palestine in all of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, the evacuation of all Israeli settlements, and creating a Palestinian capital in East Jerusalem, reestablish the pre-1967 borders. That is a tall order, and I don't see any takers on the Israeli side or on the American side either. So you might expect that it will take years for really effective Palestinian leadership to emerge, composed probably of people we don't think about at this moment, people who are sitting in Israeli prisons at this moment. There may be, of course, catastrophic events too. There may be confrontations between the Palestinian fighting organizations themselves. But I don't think this will happen, certainly not very soon, because Palestinians are very much against any kind of civil war among themselves. And I think such a struggle will be prevented.
Uri Avneri, I want to thank you for being with us, Israeli writer, peace activist, former member of the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, speaking to us from Tel Aviv. That does it for Democracy Now! Today. Our website is democracynow.org. Our producers, Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkadous, John Hamilton, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill, Mike DeFilippo, and Ryan Abernathy, our engineers. On Wednesday, the 3rd, I'll see folks at Stony Brook University. On Thursday at Stanford, I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.